Introduction to Clinical Research podcast. My name is Debbie and I use she, her pronouns. I work in clinical research and I have decided to explain it to my friend Elise. Say hello, Elise.
Hello, Elise. 18 episodes, still going with that joke.
And trying to make it sound different, but I'm still enjoying it. So will there come a time where we drop it? Not if I'm here.
At some point, we're going to have to do, like, hello, Elise, like, just to try and get different reads on it, you know? Yeah, hi, Elise, she, her pronouns, and I don't work in clinical research, so I tag along to ask the questions that Debbie thinks are too basic to explain.
Wow. That's not it at all, Elise. Elise is a very helpful person because I am so deep in the science sometimes that Elise drags my head out of it and says, hey, look at me, I'm a real person. Yeah. And it helps me remember that sometimes big long words are not important.
No, sometimes.
All right, sometimes. We're here to pull the curtain back on medical research, so hopefully you feel a bit more informed, you can trust the outcomes of research, or you just learn a little something, maybe you're entertained as well. Today, we are going to talk about approved drugs that are under regulatory review, which is a slightly nebulous concept, but we're basically going to be looking at some drugs that have lost or might lose their approvals, or cases where like additional measures are put in place for safety reasons. And we're thinking about in terms of why it happened and what maybe the response was to it and how those two things can sometimes feed each other, right? If the response can feed a regulatory action and the cultural aspects of it, as Elise might say.
Yes. And speaking of cultural aspects for the Americans listening, that's regulatory review in case you, like me, hear regulatory.
What?
How do you say it again? Regulatory?
Regulatory.
Regulatory. Mm. It sounds totally different.
Okay, so here's the funny thing. I do this all the time where I'm like, oh, hey, croissant. But I am so rarely on the receiving end of someone else doing it to me. I am a throne. I'm like, what do you mean? The way I say it is the right way. You're the weird one. But it turns out that from your perspective, I'm the weird one. Oh.
That's true about croissant, too, just so you know. Like,
what
from
do you
my
mean?
Perspective, it's like any other word that's been adopted in...
So you would say croissant, croissant.
Yeah, I mean, it's like any other word that's been adopted into English that then you say as if, like, it's...
You don't try and hold on to the original native pronunciation.
So regulatory review.
Regulatory. Did I say it your way and you said that my way?
Yeah.
Regulatory.
Regulatory.
Oh,
is how.
Okay. It feels like I've got like a rock in my mouth that I'm trying to speak around. Because it's like the hardest brain thing I'm having to do is to say a word that I'm trying to say one way and say it a different way. It's
Don't
hard.
Say it different. Say it how
okay.
you say it.
I just won't say it at all. That's the solution. Regulatory. Yeah, so we're looking at some drugs that have or might lose their approvals because we had the episode on phenylephrine, which if you haven't listened to, you should. It's interesting. But essentially, an FDA review concluded that the data that's available does not support the use of phenylephrine as a nasal decongestant when taken orally. It's not unsafe, but it's not effective. It doesn't work. It has shown to be effective when used in nasal sprays. So this is why, like, the method of application or the formulation is sometimes very important. It can make it work or not. As a result of this, the story about phenylephrine, or maybe just because of the news that I read and where I'm plugged into, and also I think Elise has sent me a couple of cases, or other friends and family have. A few more examples have been like raised to my attention, and I thought it's a good kind of opportunity for us to lump them together and look at them. So we can dive right in. So the first example we're going to talk about is one that we've spoken about previously, is the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. I know that none of us necessarily want to think about COVID, even though it hasn't gone away. And vaccine hesitancy was a thing pre-COVID and will remain a thing in the future. But I think it's important for us to talk about it because of the cultural impacts of what happened around this vaccine. It was developed by Oxford University, an academic institution in the UK, and a pharma giant, they're huge, called AstraZeneca. They do many different types of drugs. They started the research pretty quickly after the pandemic kicked off in 2020, and the vaccine was approved on the 30th of December 2020. And what I want to talk about particularly around this one is the cultural impact of the kind of the public panic is a strong word, but the concern and anti-vax sentiment that affected this vaccine's popularity when compared to the data that caused the reaction, right? This vaccine is no longer being offered in the UK as part of booster programs, partly because of, I found this phrase on the internet, an overabundance of caution, right? Over side effects. So we know that everything has side effects, right? But sometimes we're a little bit more risk averse in situations. So this overabundance of caution is exactly that. But also due to public perception, right? The public looked at this particular example and the news reports around it and went, I don't want to take that.
Right.
And I think that's valid, right? Because in this case, we had other options. Vaccine hesitancy is understandable. And I mean, there's a whole wormhole that I want to fall in at some point about science communication and, you know, like why certain population groups are mistrustful of medicine and science and pharma, and I am mistrustful of pharma and I'm in it, you know? So I'm not trying to disregard anybody's valid concerns or hesitation. I think historically we've not done a great job at communicating about risks, benefits or research methods. And nobody did a good job of explaining during the pandemic how we went from nothing to a vaccine in 9 months, when the narrative has been, for my working life anyway, that it takes 10 years to get a drug approved.
Right.
You look at that and you go, that someone's cutting corners. Mm-hmm. They have to. Mm-hmm. It's completely understandable that you look at that and go, what the fuck? So in the UK, just to set the scene, we have a system called the yellow card scheme.
Sounds fake.
Sounds fake.
It's literally right. Says scheme in the name. Like, scheme is not a good word.
Okay. Well, I will write to the MHRA and tell them. Okay, good. How's that? Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And under this scheme, doctors and or patients can report incidents of adverse effects. So any kind of medical side effect, you can report to the MHRA. And it's important, particularly for newer drugs, or if the effect is something that's not in the little leaflet that you get in your package of medications, that's what's expected, right? Doctors will often report stuff if it's not on that leaflet, because that's new and surprising information. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that isn't going to capture all events, because I bet you, me, anyone else has had a side effect from a drug and we haven't reported it. Particularly if you look in the package, the leaflet, and you go, oh, X percent of patients get Y side effect. I've got that. Okay, no big deal. The MHRA are still collecting safety reports for this vaccine, as well as any other drug that's on the market in the UK. It's not like we only collect them for this amount of time. It's ongoing. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good method of collecting and aggregating safety information. It's a very useful tool. But the important thing to remember that I would like to stress right at the top before we get into any further details is the vast majority of side effects for this vaccine, and as with most vaccines, are mild and short term. And this is the bit of science that I think that people don't adequately explain when they say that bit about vaccine side effects are short term and mild. They don't explain why that is often the case. Mm-hmm. And the reason that is often the case is what the vaccine does, which is different to many other medicines, is it stimulates your body to do a thing that your body it does anyway. Mm-hmm. Have an immune response to a thing, right? You get a bacterial infection, your body is going to mount an immune response to that. You get a cold, your body does an immune response to that. Whatever infectious agent attacks your body has an immune response to it. And the immune response, it's complicated and multifaceted and interlocking, and it's super cool. I love immunology, but your body does it. And how well your body does it is affected by lots of different things, right? Some people's immune system kicks ass. Other people's is too busy attacking themselves, like an autoimmune disease, mm-hmm. or getting really fucking excited about pollen.
That's mine.
That's me. As for my friend Elise. Yeah.
So excited about pollen. Welcome to hay fever season.
Right?
We're covered but in it's, hives. It's,
but your body is doing a thing that it does normally. Mm-hmm. It's just doing it at the wrong stimulus. Yes. So sorry about that.
Me too.
So many, many other medicines, like if you're taking a painkiller or a beta blocker or whatever it may be, usually those medicines are blocking something or enhancing a process for the period of activity that drug has in your body. And there may be side effects to that over long-term or short-term usage because of the interlocking nature of all of these processes and things, right? Whereas your body's immune response, if it's behaving normally, it happens all the time with very little impact to the rest of your bodily function, because it's kind of in balance, in homeostasis with the rest of your bodily function. When it's out of balance, you're allergic or autoimmune.
Mm-hmm.
So once your immune system clears the vaccine from your system by generating this response to give you the immunity, the antibodies that you need, there's no part of that vaccine left floating around in your body to cause an issue. All that you've got left is the memory of that infection in the form of antibodies, like all other infections you've had since you were a snotty-nosed baby. So the side effects that we most often see with vaccines are reactions immediately after, or shortly after, I should say, the injection. And it's stuff that is usually caused by the immediate effect of your body processing that vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the swollen sore lump on your arm because mm-hmm. you've just had a needle stuck in you and a whole bunch of inflammation's happening around that area. It's maybe you feel a bit tired or fatigued for a couple of days because your body is mounting an immune response right. against something in your body. The same way you feel when you've got an infection, you're tired,
yep.
right? Because you're fighting something. But some side effects of vaccines, you could also have an anaphylactic reaction if you're allergic to any of the ingredients in the vaccine. Just the same as you can have an anaphylactic reaction if you eat shrimp and you're allergic to shrimp.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to get down off my high horse. Soon. So in the UK, the public perception about this particular vaccine was really negative. Do you know, was it the same in the US, Elise?
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm.
People mm-hmm. didn't want it, thought it was less effective, definitely thought it was more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, I got injected my two doses and I think my booster were all Pfizer. So I'm not sure that I'm allowed to slag this vaccine off or be mean about it or throw shade, as Meg would say. But in honesty, its effectiveness rates, it being the AstraZeneca vaccine, are slightly lower than either Pfizer or Moderna.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the questions around, oh, it's less effective, true. Yep, if we had nothing else, you know, it's still pretty good. It's 81% effective against early variants after two doses. Pretty good, right? Just as an aside, what that 81% means is it prevents symptomatic COVID in 81% of patients.
Mm-hmm.
who have it and are exposed to the COVID vaccine. It's not like it's a magical force field that bounces the virus off. But if you're not symptomatic, you're not in danger of all of the right. side effects that symptoms cause.
Yep.
Right? It doesn't mean that you can't then transmit it.
Mm-hmm.
There's some research and some data that shows that maybe asymptomatic patients, you carry less of a viral load.
Mm-hmm.
So you're sneezing and coughing less bits of virus out all over the place because you're sneezing and coughing less. And you have less of the virus anyway because your body's already chomping right. it up.
Yeah. Yep.
Getting rid of it. But to say that a vaccine is effective, like, oh, 81% of symptomatic cases prevented, is not the same as saying that you haven't caught it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that it's not making you sick. Anyway, my understanding of the main reason that many people were hesitant is because of these very rare side effects. The effectiveness issue. I have no issue with people saying I'd rather have the more effective drug rather than the less effective mm-hmm. drug. That's why phenylephrine is not something that I will encourage anyone to take now.
Right.
In oral form, right? Don't work. Okay, if you can get something that works better, of course you're going to take that. Of course, if you've got no other option available, maybe you're going to take the thing that is slightly less effective. But these very rare side effects, I think, caused a lot of upset. So anaphylaxis, this allergic reaction, was reported in 268 patients out of about 21.2 million as of 14th of April 2021, according to the MHRA. That's roughly one patient per 100,000, okay?
Not great and not terrible. Like, I think one out of 100,000 mm-hmm. is still higher than is comfortable for me with a lot of things.
Yep.
But also, yep. one per 100,000 is, in the grand scheme of things.
Do you know 100,000 people?
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, we were, like, fill a sports stadium four times over, and you might have 100,000 people in there.
Yeah.
And one of those uh-huh. people has anaphylaxis.
And that anaphylaxis is manageable, and I mentioned it before, right, as a possible expected side effect mm-hmm. of a vaccine, because you don't necessarily know what you're allergic to unless you've had an allergic reaction before, right?
And typically, anaphylaxis occurs within the first 30 minutes is the highest danger time. And we were, at that time, at least in the US, we were required to sit for 15 to 30 minutes, depending on where you got your injection, to make sure you didn't have a side effect like this.
Same here. And that was exactly where I was going next, Elise. So thank you so much. Yes. it's not something that it's like, okay, one in five patients are going to have this, which, yikes.
Yeah.
That would be a lot higher stress and pressure, right? But it's also something that is not one in several billion.
Yeah.
One in 100,000 is, as you said, right, closer to where we'd like it to be, but it's manageable by exactly that. Having patients sit for 10 or 15 minutes after the jab to check anything going on. And for patients who have known historical allergic reactions or known kind of immune stuff going on in certain situations, they would have their injection done like at a hospital mm-hmm. with advanced life support stuff at hand, rather than I had mine done at a vaccination clinic where like it was, there were doctors and nurses there. I knew I was in good hands, but I've also never had an anaphylactic reaction to anything.
Right.
I'm less likely to have it than someone that's had it previously. Mm-hmm. Okay, but the real headline grabber, although anaphylaxis was there, the real thing that I think caused a lot of stress was the reports of the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine causing fatal blood clots.
Yes.
So, across Europe, we had a few cases of this very, very rare side effect where the vaccine was linked to causing these blood clots. And at last count, it was 222 cases from 34 million people who had been vaccinated, which rolls down to about 7 per million patients.
Mm-hmm. So much smaller odds than
anaphylaxis. Yeah. How do you feel about that number, 7 per 1 million?
Pretty good overall. I think that it is still, I mean, like, if you think about the total population of, like, the United States, that's, you know, what, like, 400 million-ish? And then...
God, there's just so many of you!
I think that, and then you take... That might be a little high. But, you know, you can kind of in your head start thinking, like, okay, how many people would that be in the entire United States? I think it's, I guess... These numbers by themselves often look very scary, and sometimes you can put them in context of other things that we accept risks around. because I remember reading about this during COVID. It was like an article I read about the idea of risk management and people, like, the risk that you take, for example, getting in a car. Every single time you get in a car, you have a certain percent chance of being in a fatal crash or in a crash that seriously leaves you injured, right? Or leaves you seriously injured, I should say. And, like, those odds are so much higher than 7 in 1 million, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, but we accept that risk every day.
Yes. And I think that's the important thing is, I listen to a podcast called More or Less, which is done by the BBC. And they will often say numbers like, oh, the budget that Russia spends on defense is X million dollars. And then they ask the question, is that a big number?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is that relevant in context?
Yeah.
And they do some really great work in breaking these things down. And so that's exactly where we want to go to next, is trying to put that number in a bit more context around similar events.
Yeah.
Right? Because the idea of having a blood clot, like, if you're having a blood clot, like a deep vein thrombosis, you know, the ones that people worry about when they get on planes. Mm-hmm. Or if you have a blood clot in your brain that can cause you to have a stroke. Mm-hmm. These are all bad things, yes. Right? There's, with the exception of wound healing, your blood clotting is not something that you usually want to happen.
Right. And the problem is that then the clots eventually end up in a space that they can't move through, and then your blood doesn't flow to your brain, or your blood doesn't flow
or wherever it needs to go,
and therefore you, like, circulation cuts off and you can potentially die.
Have a bad time.
Yeah. Or otherwise have
absolutely.
A bad time, yes.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And how that presents, whether it's a clot in your lung, a pulmonary embolism, or a clot in your brain, depending on where the clot ends up getting stuck, mm-hmm. it's going to cause you to have different symptoms, outcomes, but they're all bad.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's wild to me is how big this story got with how rare these clots are when you compare it to other similar cases of blood clotting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the rate of similar blood clots from patients taking hormonal contraception over 10 years, which is something that I did, the risk falls between this range, 3 in 1,000 people at the low end to 1 in 100 people at the highest end. So depending on where you are in the world and some other risk factors, you'll fall somewhere in that range. which is substantially higher.
Substantially higher.
Than 7 in a million.
Yeah, ask me again. Do I know 100 people? Yeah.
Yeah.
Do I know 100 people on hormonal contraception? Probably vaguely. Probably. Yeah.
Yeah.
If not directly, then at least vaguely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I reckon you and I could sit down and get a list.
Yeah, of 100 people likely to be on hormonal contraception that between us.
Or who have been over 10 years.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yet those drugs are still on the market and taken frequently by many people, including many people who know these risks, mm-hmm. right? So interestingly, I came off of these drugs because I was starting to show an increase in my blood pressure, which is like a precursor to potentially having a clot. Mm-hmm. And this is around about the same time that my dad had had a stroke. Well, my dad had a stroke a few years earlier. And so the doctors monitored me really closely mm-hmm. because they thought maybe there's something going on here. And my blood pressure was trending upwards. And so the doctor said, well, you should come off this because it's potentially higher risk for you. Mm-hmm. So I did. Again, just because something is a risk, like with anaphylaxis, doesn't mean we can't manage it. Doesn't mean there aren't other options. Doesn't mean you can't have the medicine. It just might mean you need some closer monitoring. Also, and not to panic anyone, the risk in pregnancy is 5 times higher than the normal risk during and in the 3 months after birth.
The risk of having a blood clot.
A blood clot. So if I have a risk of me and people like me, 1 in 500 patients have it. If I'm pregnant or in the 3 months immediately after having birth, it's 1 in 100. Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think even 1 in 100 is not a large number.
No.
Right? It's not like 1 in 5.
Yeah, but 1 in 100, I mean, I do think that's like pretty significant.
Okay.
I do.
Okay.
Like, I think 1 in 100, like, you know, I can, like...
It's not what I would call rare.
Yeah.
But it's also not a guarantee.
Yeah.
And if you think, like 1 in 3 marriages ends in divorce.
Or 1 in 2, here in the US. Yeah.
And the number of people who are still like myself, married. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Like, that seems like a stupider thing to do than to take a medicine that might give you a 1 in 100
chance. There's a reason some of us aren't married.
It's because you're smart. It's because you're smart. I love my husband. He listens to this podcast.
So you have to say it. Yeah, you're contractually obligated. Yeah, yeah. It's in your vows.
Yeah.
In sickness and in health. And if I ever have a podcast, every 18 episodes, I'll tell people I love you.
I'll admit to being married and that actually I'm quite lucky. But anyway, the point here is it is important that when we are talking about risks, we understand the context of it and whether or not the number that we're seeing is a large number. Mm-hmm. It's interesting the risks that we will tolerate about certain things like getting in the car or having a baby mm-hmm. or getting married and not other things like having a vaccine, mm-hmm. even when the side effects are substantially less likely to happen, mm-hmm. like 7 in a million.
Yeah.
That's really, really freaking rare.
Yeah.
Like if you think of your chance of getting cancer now is like 1 in 3 or 1 in 4. And that's just from living your life.
It's terrifying.
Right? It is. It is. It's shit. There's so much misinformation out there about vaccines. And I wish there was a way that we could talk about vaccines scientifically, like we've just tried to, right?
Yeah.
Like let's identify, you know, it isn't as effective, but it's still quite effective. Here are the risks and here they are in context. I wish that we could do that without having to debunk bloody Andrew Wakefield every time.
Yeah. Because I mean, ultimately, like anytime someone starts being like, oh, a vaccine has risks, it opens the door to, well, one of those risks must be that it causes autism because that was a thing that got said one time and then everybody...
That guy said it one time, despite there being no evidence.
No evidence. Cannot stress enough how untrue this is. Yeah, but I mean, the kind of, besides debunking Andrew Wakefield, which again, every day, all the time, happy to do. There's also just, I mean, I think the risk tolerance that people have and how it is not connected to numbers at all is worth talking about. Because it's not about, like, it's about what we perceive as risky to us because of how often we put ourselves in that situation. I get in a car every day, and I have been in 3 fender benders in my life. Therefore, I'm safe in a car, right? My experience of being in a car is I'm relatively safe in this car. It doesn't actually, the perception of how likely I am to get hit in a way or whatever, and then have a terrible outcome. Knowing those odds is nothing against experiencing a lifetime of being in a car and not having that happen to me, right? Mm-hmm. And not because it's logical, because that's how humans process the world.
We're not logical. And I think sometimes we pretend to be when we aren't.
Right.
Right. Like when people say, oh, I don't want to have that vaccine because it's not as effective or something, something, something. It's much more visceral.
Yes.
Or irrational. Yes. Or emotional. Or
we're dressing up.
You think you're being really logical about it.
We're dressing up our fear reaction in the guise of logic. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's not to be dismissive of that, as that's how all human beings are, myself included. I horse ride every week, which from a risk perspective is stupid. It's really dangerous getting on a horse, and I've fallen off more times than I care to remember. All of the concussions that I've had are from falling off horses, and there have been several. But I still do it.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. It is a choice, but more than anything, in any situation, I would like a choice to be informed.
Yeah.
Right. And if you look at something and you go, hormonal contraception risk of blood clots, maximum high of 1 in 100 people, that's too high for me. I don't want to do it. Okay. Valid. Great. Love that. Well done. But I don't want to have a vaccine because it might give me or my child autism. No.
Right. No, that's not. Well, I mean, that's not
even. I want to have my vaccine in a hospital ready in case I have an anaphylactic reaction. Valid. Because you might.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
And all of that disregards all of the other cultural aspects as to why certain people or populations may be less trusting of quote unquote the medical establishment.
Right.
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 Which we know is a thing based on how we treated people in the past.
Yeah, but there's also and that's like valid and good to talk about, and we will, I'm sure, again, because we've talked about it before, we'll talk about it again. But what we're alluding to is racism. Isms in the but there's also a type of vaccine hesitancy and also like medical mistrust that comes from something less understandable, less explainable, less, I don't know, that has more to do with like, it's like the people who believe the conspiracy theories about like the government is putting a microchip in me when they give me a vaccine, right? That's also part of this story. Yes. And that, like there's going to be overlap between causes for vaccine hesitancy that are from legitimate, historical, important, and frankly, horrible things that have happened to groups of people where you're like, I understand why you don't trust the government and why you don't trust the medical institution, right? Medical institutions. And there's another sector of people where it comes from bad actors who know that they can influence people who aren't information literate, aren't good at looking up and finding good information on their own, and have this misplaced mistrust where what they're really feeling is, so, okay, this is me on my high horse, but like so much of the angst of the current world situation, the shit that is the truth of climate change, that is the truth of our economic system, and the way that it's only getting worse, and the poor are getting poorer, the rich are getting richer, the middle class is going away. We have all these issues, income inequality, wage deterioration, the whole nine yards, and people take advantage of that for their own good and create medical and governmental mistrust where it really shouldn't be. And that sucks.
Yes.
Because there aren't any fucking microchips in your goddamn vaccines. As someone who works in the department that does the vaccines, I can tell you there's simply no way that we could ever pull that
off. What is more likely? This is something that someone said to me, and I can't remember who it is, but if it was you, this was brilliant insight, and thank you. What is more likely? All of the people in the government, healthcare, pharmaceutical industry, or who are tangentially related to those things, are consistently lying without like evidence, or like no one slipped up, no one's dropped a ball, there's not been a leak of like the schematics of the chips,
no one got a little drunk and told their best friend about it
and
at girls'
their
night.
Best friend, which we've all done, right?
Friend DA.
What's more likely? That, or it is a conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been listening to some podcasts about conspiracy theories recently. I don't know, there just must be something in the air. And the problem, quote unquote, is that sometimes what happens is a conspiracy theory turns out to be reality.
Mm.
Right? Because it's not a conspiracy theory. It's something suspicious seems to be going on here. We need to investigate it further. Mm-hmm. And then you investigate it further and you go, oh shit, I was right. Like in the UK, we had this whole scandal with the post office and they had some machines, and the machines were all fucky, and basically a bunch of people went to prison, and a few people died by suicide because of it. They'd been basically accused of stealing money from the post office, and it was because the computer was fucky. And this has been, like, investigative journalists have done some really incredible work to kind of get to the bottom of this, and there was a dramatization on the telly earlier this year, and now everyone's up in arms about it, even though this happened, like, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. But that's not a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
That is reality that wasn't public knowledge, mm-hmm. then becoming public knowledge. And I think the difference between that and a conspiracy theory for me is, when you do the investigation, when you find out the stuff, and you go, actually, there's no evidence of this, mm-hmm. it could be because there's a cover-up, or, much more likely, it's just, as you said, a bad actor spreading some disinformation.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, I definitely got on my high horse a little bit there, but that kind of stuff really gets me, so...
Yeah, it's difficult to manage, yeah. And you're absolutely right to point it out as a very valid part of vaccine hesitancy and the anti-vax movement. Mm-hmm. I think, to me, I like to separate those two things, right? Vaccine hesitancy, mm-hmm. I'm on board with. I'll talk to you about it all day. We can look at the risks. We can discuss. And your doctor should do the same with mm-hmm. you, right? I'm not a doctor, but if we can sit down and kind of pick apart, like, what are you worried about? Some worries are completely legitimate and very reasonable. And hesitancy about lots of things is mm-hmm. is smart. Mm-hmm. It's self-preservation mm-hmm. compared to the bad actor anti-vax stuff.
Yeah.
I'm less patient with that.
For sure.
So to wrap this one up, it seemed that younger persons were particularly at risk with these blood clots. So when the initial report surfaced, here's the thing that I was happy about. In the UK, for example, the guidance was changed. So if you were particularly young, Meg, aged 18 to 24, you got Moderna or Pfizer instead. And in fact, in many European countries, anyone over or under certain ages was restricted from getting it as well. Because when the evidence changes, the practice should change. And we, as a rich country who hoarded a bunch of vaccines, which is a different conversation for a different day, we were able to have enough stock of vaccines on hand to be able to give people Pfizer or Moderna instead, which didn't have the same reports. Right. Any questions on that one?
No.
Good.
Good.
Next, we're going to talk about a drug called Montelukast.
Bless.
Which is a treatment for asthma. Okay, quick background. It's launched by Merck, another huge pharma company, in 1998. It works by stopping your airways narrowing to help prevent an asthma attack.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what we're going to talk about for this one is how we tolerate risk in medicine. And the thing that is the least favourite bit of my life, scientific uncertainty. And I say the least favourite bit because it's ubiquitous, it's everywhere, and it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You can never be certain about anything in science. You just have the thing that is most strongly proved mm-hmm. based on the evidence. Mm-hmm. But if the evidence changes, then science reacts to that, right? The practice should change.
Yeah.
Okay, this drug, Montelukast, is currently under review by the MHRA in the UK after children and adolescents taking it have suffered some extreme mental health side effects whilst taking the drug. It has been associated with night terrors, depression, and in rare cases, hallucinations and suicidal behaviour. Parents have also reported uncontrolled aggression, behavioural changes, and violence.
Those are pretty extreme things.
Mental health side effects. Mm-hmm. Yes, they are. And they're not new information. This hasn't come out of the sun in 2024. The EU completed a review published in July 2019. That's a very long time ago now. Highlighted the known risk of neuropsychiatric events, these behaviour and mood changes. But also some very rare, well, okay, we call it very rare, 1 in 10,000 cases of children developing a stutter whilst taking the medication, over half of which resolved when the medication was stopped.
Hmm.
The side effects, the behaviour and mood changes, and the stutter are listed on the patient information sheet, right? They're expected, quote unquote. They're on the pamphlet. Okay. It's also interesting, and I think this is correct, right? A stutter is not something that you want a medicine to give your child.
Right.
Right? It's not a side effect that you're going to be like, yeah, okay, that's fine, I'm on board with that. The positive here is over half of that resolved, right? The medication was stopped, the stutter went away. And then when they re-challenge, so they reintroduce the medicine, it comes back.
Mm.
The reason that they do that is to show that the medicine is causing it.
Yeah.
You take it away, it goes away. You reintroduce it, it comes back. Guess what the causative agent is? Okay. However, additionally, there's a UK action group that are campaigning for more prominent warnings, stricter controls or support for those that are affected because they want patients to consult more closely with doctors earlier on and to say that warnings should be printed on the packet and flagged by health professionals. Interestingly, this is one of the differences between our regulatory environments.
Regulatory.
Yes, thank you. Honestly, it's like trying to learn to walk again. In the US, your system's a little different. The drug for you has what's called a black box warning and has had since 2020. That's the highest level of safety warning that can be assigned by the FDA. And literally on the outside of the box is a black box mm-hmm. that tells you your big, bad, negative side effects.
Right.
We don't have that system here in the UK. Everything is printed in the leaflet. And this action group are kind of asking for the MHRA to do something like the FDA do.
Okay.
Okay. The reason that the FDA have that black box warning is because they've looked at animal studies which suggest that the drug can cross the blood-brain barrier, which is kind of like a membrane that acts as a filter and keeps stuff out of your brain, right? It's in your blood, but it's not in your brain. And interestingly, Letitia James, who's the New York Attorney General, has written to the FDA this year, 2024, and asked them to take immediate action over the drug. Hmm. I don't know why an attorney general is expressing an opinion about pharmaceutical, but that's because I don't understand how your system works.
Yeah, now that you say that, like, I can think of times where we have, like, attorney general warnings on things, and it is related to drugs. And then, you know, I don't know why or how that gets kind of in the mix.
You're a lawyer, right? Attorney general's a lawyer?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool, great.
Things whatever. I definitely know backwards and forwards.
Yeah. Anyway, so the action group in the UK estimates that about 350,000 patients are prescribed the drug in England, including more than 35,000 children, based on NHS data. And the drug is legally allowed to be given to babies as young as 6 months old. So it is a drug that can be given to quite young children. And these negative side effects, these behavioural and mood side effects, seem to occur for children and adolescents, not for adults. So, like we saw with the vaccine that we were just mm-hmm. talking about, age seems to be a factor mm-hmm. in when something may affect you.
Okay.
So that means that maybe age is a factor in prescribing guidelines going forwards.
Right.
Okay. The MHRA are currently investigating, so this is one that we're going to keep our eyes on. But their website has some information that's quite useful already. Again, I want to put this in context. This is not to say that I'm dismissing the side effects or like being dismissive of very serious mental health and neuropsychiatric conditions, because they can be extremely difficult to live with, let alone as a child or a parent trying to manage mm-hmm. a child with any of these right. things. Okay. These are serious things, but we need to look at it in context of how many cases there are, right? How likely the event is to occur. So in the UK, between 2014 and 2018, so we're a couple of years out of date, granted, but this is the data that's available. Sometimes you've got to work with what you got. The MHRA received 219 reports of suspected adverse, bad neuropsychiatric reactions. This is through the yellow card scheme that we met before. During which time, so at the same period of these 219 reports, about 14 million prescriptions for this drug, Montelukast, went out. So that's about 2 per 100,000, okay? So anaphylaxis in the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine was 1 in 100,000. So these side effects are twice as frequent as that. 2 in 100,000.
Okay.
Okay? But 14 million prescriptions, 219 reports.
I know. But we are kind of expecting that 219 reports through the yellow card scheme, which we've already said is likely to have an underreporting bias, right?
Yes.
And I would say if you don't know it's possibly a side effect and you've got a kid coming into their teenage years and in COVID, you expect them to be having certain psychiatric effects, mental health effects.
So all of these, this data is pre-COVID. It's up to 2018.
That's fair.
So you're not wrong. Yeah. But remember that this data was what caused the leaflet to be updated to capture these events.
Got it.
So at this time, these events weren't known side effects.
I see.
So they were more likely to have been reported.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the data that we get now probably is going to lean more towards underreporting because it's in the leaflet. So people expect it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You're right. It does lean more towards underreporting, but it's the only system we've got to get this data.
Sure, absolutely. Like, I'm not... Yeah, I guess, like, it's just... It is likely, I think, especially with neuropsychiatric behavioral mental health changes, I think it's very easy to think, well, my kid's going through a rough patch. This is because their grandmother died. This is like they have a slight behavioral change, which might be because of the medicine. And then something because of that behavioral change goes wrong at school. And now there's you've got a logical fallacy of like, oh, I think it's because things have started going wrong at school that they're depressed. Well, the depression actually came first due to the
and
all those kinds of things, like, just it really muddies the water for me in terms of like what we could possibly claim is like a true quote-unquote number of these side effects.
Yes. Okay, I agree. And I don't disagree with what this action group want in any way, because what they're asking for is basically that the doctor has a very frank and honest discussion with the parents and maybe the child, depending on their age, to say, hey, these are potentially coming down the track. You need to look for these things.
Right.
And here is maybe what we're going to do if that happens.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't happen to you because you're, you know, the other 999,998 people in the 100,000 people, well, however the maths works, I don't know, at least. 99,998. Yeah. Then great. Go for your life.
Yeah.
No worries.
Yeah.
And even if it's, you know what, it's 5 in 100,000.
Right.
If you're prepared to look for something, like with the anaphylaxis situation, right? You're going to have this injection in a situation where you can be monitored. If someone is monitoring you for this side effect, great. And so I think if the drug is effective and safe in many other ways, then something like this can be monitored. And if that drug causes that side effect in the patient, withdraw it.
Yeah.
Let their equilibrium reset.
This also reminds me of our discussion around some things to do with, like, for example, cancer treatments or even the ALS treatment that we talked about, and like the alternative of, right, which we didn't even talk about with the COVID vaccine, right, but that the alternative of not having the vaccine is also a risk, or the alternative of not having an asthma treatment for your child is also a risk. And so one of the things to consider in these cases is what else is available. So in the COVID vaccine, we did talk about the fact that we had Moderna and Pfizer as available, if not more available in some places than AstraZeneca.
Yes.
And so it was easy to say, okay, well, I don't have to accept the risk of not being vaccinated, and I can also reject the risk of AstraZeneca by choosing Pfizer or Moderna for myself, if you're privileged enough to live in a place where that was an option. And with something like an asthma treatment, if this is, you know, you've gone through 3-4 different treatments and nothing has worked, and the alternative is your kid has daily asthma attacks and you're constantly, you know, like living in a tent, an oxygen tent, to try and keep an infant alive, this might be the better option.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that context is important, right? And the prescribing guidelines should cover that. And that's why many of these things are put under review, right? Is to balance that risk benefit. And something I should have looked into when we talked about the vaccines and blood clots is, I know that symptomatic infection with COVID had a rate of causing blood clots.
Mm.
And I would bet my socks it's higher than the rate
that
we saw with the AstraZeneca vaccines. I don't know. I haven't got that data.
Right.
But I bet it is.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important context, right? Is the risk of not treating the thing, or the risk of treating the thing with other available options. If they are effective, well, maybe that's the one you go for.
Yeah.
But if you're at last chance saloon, then managing the risk is the most important thing. And managing risks starts with knowing about the risk.
Yeah.
So I don't think this action group are at all in the wrong about saying this needs to be front and center and known about, because, you know, one child or adolescent dying by suicide is too many if it's preventable in this case, right?
Yeah.
But, and also, like in the UK, our provision of mental health care is dire. So I would be really nervous about them taking this drug off the market, saying, oh, you know, it's too risky, these neuropsychiatric side effects for patients, too risky. Like, yeah, but what about all of the patients who have neuropsychiatric issues, challenges, diagnoses, conditions, without it being caused by a drug?
Yeah.
Like me.
Yeah.
You know?
Are we giving care? Are we like, if it's so serious that we have to take this drug off
the market
to prevent 2 out of 100,000, right? Are we managing
all of the kids that have gone through COVID and that are
yeah.
that we know the data has shown are having a rough time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like this is intimately part of my work.
Yeah. Okay, so our third example, friends, is, Elise, do you want to say this drug?
Crizanlizumab.
Crizanlizumab, yeah, you did it. Crizanlizumab.
It sounds, I don't even have a good joke about what it sounds like.
Okay, but do you remember why it's called MAB? Why it's got a MAB at the end? Do you remember where that comes from?
I remember that there's something about that, and I was going to be a smart aleck and tell you it has to do with something about, like, how the, because this is true about, like, rocks, too, if it's mite or whatever at the end, it depends on how the molecules all arrange themselves and stuff. So
yeah oh my god, my dad would be so proud of you. He's a geologist.
My dad's a civil engineer. He's as close to a geologist as you can get without being a geologist. No, I don't remember. I remember that it's a thing. It's an acronym.
Monoclonal antibody.
Monoclonal antibody. It's an acronym.
It's a type of molecule. Yeah
It's sold under the trade name Adakvio, if that's easier for you to say.
No, that's also bad. Shame on those people. Oh, call God. It Frank.
Okay. All right. Okay, so Frank.
Yes.
Crizanlizumab, a.k.a. Frank, was introduced in 2020 and has been relied on by many patients to help support their life with sickle cell disease. Okay, here's your two-second primer on sickle cell disease. Sickle cell anemia is an inherited blood disorder that causes your red blood cells to be sickle-shaped rather than round. This causes a few problems because that's not the shape they should be. Mm-hmm. They are more likely to kind of clump together and get stuck, causing a blockage, like a clot, but not like that, which is called a vaso-occlusive crisis. Mm-hmm. And also, in general, they mean that people with sickle cell anemia have fewer red blood cells than is normal, which is why they are anemic.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder for them to get oxygen around the body because they have fewer red blood cells that transport oxygen, okay?
Got it.
Symptoms include pain, jaundice, fatigue, over time can lead to tissue damage. And these vaso-occlusive crises in patients with sickle cell disease can cause pain and tissue damage. So similar to a blood clot, they restrict the flow of blood. Okay. That's bad wherever it ends up.
Got it. This is also the disease that's known for, like, if you get a cut, it will take so much longer for it to naturally close itself.
Clot.
Is it?
Yeah, like it won't scab over. Yeah, it's the same thing. Like it.
Yeah. True. Bleeding in patients with sickle cell disease.
Because you
high incidence of bleeding in patients with sickle cell disorder, particularly from certain areas, upper GI tract. Blah 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 blah. All right. Patients with sickle cell disorder may be predisposed to bleeding. All right, Elise.
I remember that from ninth grade biology.
Okay, so Adakvio works to help manage or prevent these vaso-occlusive crises. Okay, so these blockages. And the reason that we're talking about it right now is because the MHRA, the UK regulator, have announced this year that they were withdrawing the marketing authorization for this drug in the UK. So on the 10th of January, they said, we're withdrawing it. No new patients can be prescribed the drug. Any patient on it needs to talk to their doctor about what they can do. And then all remaining supplies were recalled in February. The reason for that is they determined that the drug is not sufficiently effective in reducing the number of crises. So similar to...
Phenylephrine.
Thank you.
It don't work.
It seems that it doesn't work enough, sufficiently effective.
Yeah.
Right? No concerns were raised about its safety. The FDA have now announced that they're also going to do a review to see if they want to do the same thing. Now, the reason that I wanted to talk about this is because this is not like phenylephrine, where there are other products on the market that can be taken. There is an extreme lack of suitable available treatments for sickle cell disease.
Mm-hmm.
This, Adakvio, crizanlizumab, was the first new drug to be introduced in, guess how long, Elise? Guess how long since the last sickle cell drug came on the market?
Gosh. 10 years.
20.
20 years, naturally, of course.
So what this means is patients with sickle cell anemia are now back to a single approved treatment option available on the NHS. We're still waiting if another approved treatment's going to be available. So a new drug has been recently approved and the NHS is trying to decide, can they make it available? Mm-hmm. But NICE, who are the people who decide what the NHS is going to pay for, have recently rejected a gene therapy called exa-cel. So that means you can get it if you can pay for it. But that fucking sucks because... Not everybody, in fact, very few people have the money to pay for stuff like this.
Yeah.
All right. Why are there so few sickle cell treatments on the market? Here we go. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, this is in the US,
mm-hmm.
provides funding for clinical trials for a whole bunch of different disorders. We're going to focus on sickle cell disease, because that's what this drug does, and cystic fibrosis.
Mm-hmm. Your lungs fill with fluid.
Because that's a comparator. It's not the same. It's not like remotely similar as a disorder, but they're useful for comparisons. A 2020 study published in the journal... What's JAMA? Journal of some American Medical Association? Journal of the... Yes. Journal of the American Medical Association showed that NIH funding and research expenditure, as well as articles, so stuff written about mm-hmm. drugs and drug approvals, are greater for cystic fibrosis than sickle cell disease. And you may say, oh, okay, but probably more people have cystic fibrosis than sickle cell disease. Fuck no. Sickle cell disease is 3 times more prevalent in the US than cystic fibrosis. Yet, cystic fibrosis gets a much, much greater amount of federal funding. Not pharma funding, federal mm-hmm. funding. Your tax dollars, yes. Americans. Yes. In fact, in some years, as much as 11 times more.
I have a...
For a third of the patients.
Not the only thing that matters in this case, though, is how many people are affected, but also severity of the disease, right? Like, do they mm-hmm. roughly cause the same outcomes if you have cystic fibrosis and if you have sickle cell anemia of, like, major, like, detriment to...
Hospital visits, life expectancy. Yeah. I think that's why this comparison is used. Okay. The mechanism is different, but in terms of life expectancy and the amount of time you spend at doctors and hospitals, they're similar. They're not going to be the same. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Here's the important bit. Well, the important bit, right? Okay, so we're talking about two diseases that aren't the same, but we're drawing comparisons between them. And this is for why. The majority of patients who have sickle cell disease, sickle cell anemia, are African American. They are black patients. Mm-hmm. The majority of cystic fibrosis patients are not.
And we're talking about in the United States, right? Like,
correct.
Because I remember in class when we learned about sickle cell anemia, which who knows why we did and why it stuck with me, but we talked about it often in the case of actual from Africa folks, from Africa, and that it is a very prevalent disease in Africa. And
yes,
that I don't know if we ever talked about it in relationship to black Americans.
To America, yes. Okay, so the risk for sickle cell anemia is highest among people with ancestors from sub-Saharan Africa. Hispanic areas in South America, the Caribbean, Central America, America, mm-hmm. some parts of Saudi Arabia, India, Mediterranean countries.
Okay.
And I don't know all of the detail about this, but my understanding of why it's prevalent in those areas is because it co-locates mm-hmm. with malaria.
Mm.
Because having sickle cells means you are more resistant to malaria.
Yep, I remember it.
Right? So there's an evolutionary pressure that you are less likely to die of malaria and therefore more likely to be able to reproduce if you have sickled red blood cells.
Yep.
Okay, then you're passing on the trait, sickle cell trait, to cause that if you have both copies of the gene, sickle, blah, 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 to cause sickle cell disease. And so that's why it's in areas where historically there's been a lot of malaria,
mm-hmm.
right? Yep. There was probably a few people way, way back in history who had this slight sickling of their cells that gave them an evolutionary advantage. Yes.
Got it.
That allowed them to procreate.
Yes, makes sense.
Okay, so 11 times more funding for cystic fibrosis, a disease predominantly for white people. As Elise put it in the notes of the episode, don't look now. Racism is back. Oops, it never left.
Yeah. Never left.
Yeah. And it just sucks that there is this example that's so flamingly obvious. Yeah. Right? You look at these numbers and you go, I don't know how someone would explain it as anything other than racism.
Right.
Okay. So this study that we're talking about used data between 2008 and 2018, 10 years,
mm-hmm.
in an estimated US population of approximately 90,000 individuals with sickle cell disease and approximately 30,000 individuals with cystic fibrosis. And here are the headline disparities. Federal funding was greater per person, cystic fibrosis compared with sickle cell disease. So cystic fibrosis patients per person, $2,807 compared to sickle cell disease per person, $812. $2,807 to $812. That's huge.
Yeah, that's huge.
That's federal funding. So that's your tax dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Foundation spending. So I'm imagining this is like charities or foundations or like other stuff.
This is going to be brutal.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Because who's got all the money in America? Yeah. Cystic fibrosis patients, $7,690 per person compared to $102 for sickle cell disease patients.
Love that.
Isn't that great?
It's great.
Isn't that great? Okay, so those are the numbers of research spending. And research spending does affect a lot. Because you can't run a research study for free.
Right.
And you see that in the outcomes, okay? Research articles published 1,594 for cystic fibrosis versus 926 for sickle cell disease. So there's straight away, like, double-ish. It's not quite half,
yeah,
but it's way less. Yeah. And that's, and that can be like a research article could be like, I've spoken to one patient with it and I'm publishing the, mm-hmm, the paper, right? It could be one of those like story papers that, yeah, that talks just about one patient. It still costs, yeah, money to do those. What I haven't looked at is kind of any kind of quantitative analysis of the types of research articles, right, whether, you know what, the 1,594 cystic fibrosis papers, they're all multi-center, randomized, mm-hmm, double-blind controlled, yeah, yeah, studies, yeah, compared to 926.
The gold standard kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know, but I would guess.
Yeah.
That would be one of my hypotheses going in doing that analysis. And then, further down the track, more FDA drug approvals for cystic fibrosis compared to sickle cell disease. 4-1. So 4 drug approvals for cystic fibrosis compared to 1 for sickle cell disease.
Sucks.
It sucks. It sucks hugely. And this is something that, having a drug on the market, crizanlizumab, that maybe doesn't work as well as they want it to, like, in most other situations, you'd go, yeah, okay, take it off the market if it doesn't work. People shouldn't be paying for it. They shouldn't be having the risk of taking a drug that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But there's fucking nothing else.
Yeah.
And there's nothing else because we refuse to invest money in many diseases. It's not just sickle cell disease. A lot of, like, quote-unquote tropical medicine, right? Stuff that happens not in America,
right,
or, you know, or it doesn't happen to the, what we think of as the dominant population. We just don't invest and give a shit in.
Yeah.
And it's, the pharma companies will always say, like, oh, it's, you know, we got to be smart with our dollar spend, you know, because we've got to be able to claw back the money. Like, no. You should spend the money where the need is greatest.
And also maybe, like, take a good hard look at, like, where the outgoing money really goes when it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You, like, look at the profits. No pharma, yeah, company is not making fucking blockbuster profits at the moment. So, yep. I and know then, you've got the money.
Yeah, and, like, you don't have to pay your CEO $1 billion a year.
No.
You don't have to.
But even then, all of the numbers we've talked about today in terms of research spending, yeah, have been federal and foundation, yes, spending. Not, yep, a fucking mention of pharma.
That's true.
So it's not just the pharma industry being a piece of shit.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
I'm mad about it.
Yeah, well, you should be. It's something to be mad about. And, like, I don't know. It's in its own way, it's not surprising. And, like, foundations...
Oh, no.
...are critical and important parts of funding things. But there is also, like, so much inequity that occurs... because of who gets,
oh, yeah,
who gets,
who runs foundations, who donates, mm-hmm, to foundations,
how you can market, gets, and, yeah, like, yeah, you know like rich people know each other, right? Like, we know this, and, like, a rich person who has a GoFundMe gets so much more money than a poor person who has a GoFundMe. Like, we know this, and it's the same principle, because your kid has cystic fibrosis. That's tragic and awful whether you're rich or poor. But when you're rich, you can, yep, say to all of your rich friends, oh my God, Susan has cystic fibrosis. She was just diagnosed. It's ruining our lives. Won't you consider donating to this thing? I'm going to throw a gala. We're going to raise so much money and they're going to save Susan's life. And then they do.
Yeah.
And that's what foundations are for. Right? That's literally, yeah, and they get made. That's how, like, that's why everything's called, like, Susan's Foundation and all this stuff, is because, yes, like, little Susie back in 1998 did die of cystic fibrosis. And again, that sucks. I'm not saying it doesn't. But then Susan's Foundation has, again, like, rich friends and...
how much money? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's not to say that there aren't rich people with sickle cell disease. Yeah. But there are likely to be fewer of them because we know how wealth disparity and demographics are tied. Yeah. But, and also, like, racism... being a kind of structural,
yeah,
thing is definitely also there, but also, yeah, racism being kind of an explicit thing is there.
Yeah.
And so if certain people have the choice of donating to a sickle cell charity, they may choose not to.
Yeah.
Because of who is most often affected by it, right, which is
terrible.
Like, that is the most explicit form of racism, yes, that I can think of. But I also would bet that it happens. Like, I'm not surprised, yeah, by any of this, but, right, I'm still fucking mad about it.
Right. And, like, you know, you can imagine the flyers and things that come in the mail saying, oh, won't you consider donating, and, like, who they get to put on their flyers, and the way that, you know, looking at a bunch of black kids on a flyer is not going to speak to a rich white person the way that looking at a bunch of white kids on a flyer is going to speak to a rich white person in general,
yep,
generally speaking.
Yep.
And general, like, yeah, the that is both explicit and implicit bias, right? Like, explicit bias, some people are looking at that going like, I'm not helping those people. Other people are looking at that and being like, Black people just really have it bad, right? Like, they can't be helped. There's this sense of that in like, oh, there's so many problems, like, for Black people, like, therefore I'm not going to contribute to this because this is a problem that's endemic to a population that has nothing to do with my contribution, has nothing to do with where I put my money or spend anything.
It's not about race.
It's not about race. It's just how it is. Right, exactly. And like, that's that implicit type of bias also, of just looking at it being like, I don't care about these people because I have this sense of them as being sick. I have this sense of them being poor and other and not important.
Other, right? Yeah.
Is really also a deeply critical part of this. And anyway, in conclusion, challenge your implicit biases.
It all sucks, which I think is probably why I really wanted to talk about like this today. And the because the other two examples are important, and like vaccine hesitancy, very important. Talking about risk in the UK and psychiatry, and like, and how we manage that scientific uncertainty, right? Mm-hmm. Like, when something changes, how do we react to that? What should we do? What's the right thing to do? Always, we should be looking at it. But the fact that we don't have options on the table for these patients to say, this drug doesn't work as well as it needs to work to be worth the risk, so we're going to take it off the market, which, like, is what's going on potentially with phenylephrine and many other products, right? If they don't work, it's not worth the risk to take it. I understand that. But when there's nothing else available, it sucks.
It does suck. I think I also have this feeling of like, if it, because like, phenylephrine doesn't work, right? Like, and I know that there are other things, but I'm thinking about like, I shouldn't take it if there's nothing else available anyway, because I'm taking something that, one, has, like you said, the potential of like, but I'm also paying money for something that isn't effective.
Yes.
And like, and I think that that's another piece of this, is like, with this treatment, I don't know what sufficiently effective means in this case, right?
This is the other thing. I'm suspicious of that. And this is my own bias perhaps showing, is I don't know what that means. And I couldn't find anywhere what that means. I couldn't get to the bottom of what that sufficiently effective meant, and whether they consulted with patient groups like the Sickle Cell Society in the UK to say, you know, we have this definition for what sufficiently effective is, and our patients say it's fine, right? But there's been a bit of an outcry from the patients about this, going, it works for me.
Yeah, okay.
Which is why, like, and also, like, comparing phenylephrine and crizanlizumab is bad, because like, phenylephrine is used to treat a cold or like nasal congestion, which many times, if you have nasal congestion because it's caused by a cold, it will go away by itself. Like, you'll be miserable while you're having it, but it will go away by itself. Whereas sickle cell disease is much more serious than that, right? The side effects can be extremely dangerous.
Yes.
So, to go back to the point about, I'm suspicious of that. Often, the standards that we hold people, things, etc. to are not equitable. So I know that, like, the standards that we hold Black people to aren't the same as the standards that we hold white people to. The standards that we hold trans people to aren't the standards that we hold cis people to. And so I'm curious to understand what sufficiently effective means, because are you using the same balance across all drugs? Because if you are, then why did it take so long for phenylephrine to come off the shelves?
Right. So are we pulling this earlier than we should, realistically, or like quicker or with less of a burden of ineffectiveness?
Of proof. Yeah, I don't know.
Because we don't care about actually giving people a chance, because this primarily affects Black people. I mean, I think it's like, it's, and like, before people are like, that doesn't happen, it does. We know that, like, contraception, right? Hormonal contraception for women has side effects that men, when they tested, and men had less frequent, less severe side effects with their versions of hormonal side effects. They were like, oh, we can't put that on the market. That's too severe. So, like, even in as simple a case as, like, whitewashed as it is to say men and women, right?
Yep.
Which often means we're talking about white women and white men, but not exclusively. Because we shouldn't erase other people just because that's a bias that people have too. But anyway, the point being,
it does happen.
It does happen. It does happen. They put different standards on things because of who's receiving the drug. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Interestingly, did you know that the only reason that we have hormonal contraception is because some really shitty experiments were done on people of color?
The racism is back. Oh, it never left.
Yeah. Like, I'm not surprised, but also like, fuck me. Of course, of course. But of course we don't know about that, because why would we?
If you have a reasonable grounding in ways that these things happen, and someone says, did you know
that
hormonal contraception is, you're like, oh, I can trace back the understanding of how this could have happened. It's because people were trying to sterilize or control the reproduction of Black women Because that's a thing the U.S. courts did for a long time. If you don't, Americans listening, please understand. It was a legal, it was a consequence of going to court was you could be deemed...
unfit to reproduce.
Unfit to reproduce and therefore sterilized by the courts. And guess who that happened to?
That's not ancient history either.
No.
Particularly if you're an Indigenous American, if you're a Black American, yeah. Certain populations...
The 1900s, yeah.
Worryingly recent cases of that still going on. And two young girls.
Yes.
You think you're going in for this, and actually we're doing a full hysterectomy when you are a teenager.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Cool. Yikes. So, yeah, we understand why people have medical and institutional mistrust, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to end on that cheery note. In any case, I think it's important, the case studies that we talked about here today, right? We talked about that Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine and vaccine hesitancy and all of that kind of side of things and practice changing when evidence changes, be important. We talked about Montelukast, and it's kind of at a different stage. We're still investigating and thinking about what can be done, but I hope that the practice changes some in terms of making sure that the doctors really are flagging to potential patients about these risks that are known. And then we talked about crizanlizumab and how that's no longer on the market, not available here in the UK, and what that means for patients with sickle cell disease, right? There's just not that many treatments available to them. There's one currently available on the NHS. So if that drug doesn't work for you, bad luck. That sucks.
That does suck.
Okay. We hope you enjoyed listening to our podcast. We've both been on our soapboxes this episode. So if you hated that, tough luck. It's just how we are.
Come back next week where we'll be back on our soapboxes. Yeah.
We never actually get off them.
That's true. I think you and I are really predisposed to just being like, and we live on soapboxes, actually. Yeah. And another thing.
And I think we also feed off each other a little bit, but so be it.
Oh, yeah, just a little.
If you have any questions, right, if any of the stuff in this episode, if you heard us say a number and it didn't make sense to you, or we made a logical leap and you didn't come with us, or you know, anything that you want clarifying, please do get in touch with us. You can email us at clinical.research.intro@gmail.com. We really do welcome your questions. If anything that we've said today is like provoked a thought in you, please get in touch. Please do subscribe so you get the next episode of Elise and Debbie on their soapboxes automatically. Please do rate and review. Please do check out the Clinical Research 101 Instagram page at clinical.research.intro on Instagram. Check out the website, intro to clinicalresearch.podbean.com. And finally, a big, big thank you from us to our great friend Sam Winnie for letting us use their incredible music for our intro and outro. Always the happiest bit of my editing is just listening to that, the 30 seconds either side of that. So, thanks and goodbye from me, Soapbox Debbie. Say goodbye, Soapbox Elise.
Goodbye, Soapbox Elise. Thank you.